So this is a recap. In the same way that the S matrix element for process alpha goes to beta is given in standard interaction picture perturbation theory by some, you know, n equals 0 to infinity minus I to the n over n factorial. Time ordered product. I always get that wrong. Integral. Tau 1. That's the thing that we all use for calculating S matrix elements. You know, we're imagining that we've got H is H naught plus V, and V of tau is the interaction picture for representation of V. So there's a standard argument that gives you that, which I'm more or less going to do again today later on. And then the evaluation of these matrix elements is all about taking creation annihilation operators to the left and the right. Because all it is a bunch of, it's a linear combination of monomials of A's and A daggers in specific number of particle states. And so you can evaluate those matrix elements. And the Feynman rules are expressing the kinds of terms you get. So the only point of the last half hour of last class was a slight generalization of this, which has a very similar Feynman rule statement, is you could have looked at time orderings of operators. Instead of looking at S matrix elements, you could look at correlation functions of interaction picture operators. And it's a very similar story as far as the Feynman rules go. So if you calculate, so let me make a sentence here. So Feynman rules express evaluation of, basically this whole thing. Right hand side. So similarly, quantities like, if we had been evaluating something like some n equals 0 to infinity minus I to the n over n factorial integral d tau 1 minus infinity to infinity n is not the same n, so let's say k. It's not clear why you'd be looking at these matrix elements yet, but if you had been looking at this kind of a thing, the way you would evaluate these Feynman rules would be very similar, and the only difference is that you now have creation annihilation operators coming from these operators A, which were not in the interaction Hamiltonian. That was all I was saying last time. So in itself, it's not such a big statement. But the point is that we're going to be interested in correlation functions of operators in the Heisenberg representation are going to turn into these things. So this is kind of a useful set of things to know that you can calculate using the same techniques you've been using for scattering amplitudes, and the addition of these extra operators is not really a big conceptual deal, is the was the message. So let's make that part explicit. So the Lowe's theorem says, if you take a bunch of operators, so let me make sure I say it correctly. Yeah, here is space-time coordinate, yeah. Because that's part of the time ordering. The reason I don't care about the order here is that it's all being time ordered. The time's in there, too. All right, so let me state the thing, and then we can identify what all the pieces are. So you know, in the Heisenberg representation, supposing we're calculating a state like beta out time-ordered product of a bunch of operators in the Heisenberg representation. This is, I guess we should call this A1 AK in the Heisenberg representation. So the theorem states that this, which is a Heisenberg representation correlation function, I'll come back to what these states are in a second, is equal to simply that. The n equals 0 to infinity. Representation. So where these states alpha and beta are the in and out states for the exact Hamiltonian that correspond to these states, which are the free eigenstates, which have the same labels. So where alpha, say in, and beta out are the eigenstates of H that correspond to the eigenstates alpha and beta on H naught in the remote. So out is in is the past, and in is the future. So we're in kind of the scattering picture. If there had been no operators at all, then the S matrix element would have been the overlap between the in state and the out state, labeled by the momenta that you thought were describing them. And then we would have had the statement that we start off with normally for the S matrix. And so one question is, I don't know how much, you know, before you did PS, all the things I'm saying here about, you know, in states and out states, you could have said for quantum mechanics. It's not a field theory issue. It's just really a scattering and quantum mechanics issue. So how happy are you people with in and out states as being eigenstates of the full Hamiltonian corresponding to, you know, the eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian? Which is another way of asking, you know, have you seen scattering theory in quantum mechanics? Silence. Who's happy? Okay.
Could you maybe refresh our minds?
Yeah, I can kind of in cartoon form. So it's a subject in itself, but more or less, you know, what's going on is you're, you know, if you're doing scattering, then what you should really be doing is wave packets. You know, you should really be saying that you've got, you know, you've got some sort of a wave packet that comes in, and it, another wave packet comes in, and then when they get, when they overlap, something happens because they can see the interaction between them, and then they separate as another set of wave packets. And that's the thing you're really calculating. But a trick for doing that is to think in the limit where the wave packet is almost an exact eigenstate, a momentum eigenstate, and you know that something has to go wrong in that exact limit. If you really took a momentum eigenstate, the wave packet's arbitrarily big. The interactions never turn off if it's an arbitrarily big wave packet. And so then you don't really have this asymptotic times, which things are non-interacting. But you can, you know, so there's a story in the scattering theory which says that that's true, and that burns you a couple times, but you can kind of track where the where you get burned. And you can express, essentially, make the statement for, you know, as long as these, your resolution and how accurately you knew your momentum wasn't arbitrarily fine, which is true in any experiment, then treating these things as if they're energy eigenstates is a useful way to organize the calculation, for which the ultimate justification is, if you actually really take these wave packets and follow them through, and you see that the answer that you get when the wave packets are reasonably peaked is the one you get if you had used this formalism where you imagine taking, labeling your states by energy and momentum eigenstates, which are not really packets. And so the logic is that if you, if you're doing quantum mechanics, you know, classically, if you had some sort of a, you know, scattering problem where you get something and something else goes by it, you know, the statement that you can relate exact eigenstates to free eigenstates is the statement that something happens here when the interaction happens, but asymptotically, things are moving basically in a straight line. And at the classical level, scattering is where you don't care about what the trajectory was. All you really care about is what the angle was between these asymptotic straight lines. And the statement classically would be that at late times, this trajectory, this exact trajectory, is arbitrarily close to a particular free trajectory, the straight line. And here in the past, there's a different free trajectory, which is arbitrarily close to the same exact classical path. And you're asking in the scattering problem, what's the relationship between those two free trajectories? And quantum mechanically, you make a similar story. So quantum mechanically, what you ask is, if you'd had some potential barrier or something, you know, V of X, you know that you're going to get, you know, there might be some bound states, but there's a continuum of states for energies above the potential, where all the exact energy eigenstates will be labeled by, you know, their energy, which is some continuous variable. And if you're, and if this potential kind of flattens out in the far ends, then the wave functions for this potential are going to look more and more like free particle wave functions, just plane waves, the farther out you go to either side, right? So if this is becoming very flat, then the eigenstates out here are going to look like e to the plus or minus I, you know, omega t. That'll be, I guess it'll be I, e to the minus I omega t minus x, and e to the minus I omega t plus x. So there'll be waves moving in either direction, but they're being labeled by a continuum of state of continuum variable omega. And so the statement that's the analog of the statement that free particles here and exact motion classically can be related in the past and future, and this kind of a scattering problem would be the statement that the exact eigenstates of the Hamiltonian here, so H naught plus V on psi E is equal to E psi E. So there's some exact eigenstates, which if you look at those eigenstates asymptotically, are going to look like these free particle eigenstates. And there will be one corresponding to a wave coming in. You know, when you do quantum mechanical scattering from a square well or something, there's a state which will correspond to waves coming in from the right, nothing coming in from the left, and there'll be other states corresponding to waves coming in from the left, not from the right. And the scattering problem is just asking for the overlap between a state here that's looking like a free particle and a state here which is looking like a free particle, where you make the inferences to how they're related by solving the, you know, the problem in between, the exact quantum mechanical problem, like you did here, where the exact solution is relating to asymptotic states. But the bottom line is, from the point of view of scattering, is that the statement that the exact state and the free states are labeled by the same things, and the statement that the statement is that if I take an exact state and I look at it in the remote, if supposing we do some scattering thing where I take a packet which is spread around an energy, but spread narrowly enough that I can think of it as being labeled by an energy plus some small error in the energy resolution, but where that is not really playing an important role in scattering. If I bring a packet in from the left, part of it will bounce off, part of it will go straight through. But if I think of the evolution in time of that packet, it will satisfy that e to the minus I ht, which is how real, honest to God wave functions evolve. So I'll use these are the guys that correspond to eigenstates of the full system, goes for large or small times to something which is looking like free evolution. It's going to look like e to the minus I h naught t for some state with similar labels. And so the notation I'm using is that, you could say plus or minus here to decide which direction you're going in the past or the future. But the statement that there is an exact state, an exact solution to the full equations of motion, which evolves in the remote past or future as if it was a free state, is this a statement that that's what scattering is? You've set up the problem so that interactions are not taking place in the far future and far past. And so in field theory, it's the same kind of a thing that these states, so what you do is you define these plane wave states. So if you like, we're labeling them by E. So I'm using, I guess, in and out, where in this definition, T goes to minus infinity would be in. So that's E minus, and this is. So energy, in this kind of a problem, for every energy, there's two solutions, as you saw in the free problem, because you could have things moving either direction. And so the same thing will be true for the exact system, that there's a doubly degenerate set of states for given energy. And so then you're just choosing them according to the boundary condition that they have in the remote future and past. And that boundary condition in a scattering problem is that you're asking that they evolve in the same way as a free state would have evolved. And you're using the fact that the labels of these exact eigenstates are the same as the labels of the free eigenstates. So when I use psi here on both sides, that's, in this case, the label was energy. So there's a continuum in the exact problem, there's a continuum in the free problem, and so they're both there's two bases of states you can use to describe things, the ones that diagonalize the free Hamiltonian and the ones that diagonalize the exact Hamiltonian. So I guess I should have written that this way. So. This could have been plus or minus, whereas the exact, the free thing would be the thing that satisfies this. So here I'm just using the same language for the fields, alpha and beta or whatever your labels were, and they're labeling particle states, so they're momenta and energies and things, and those, in a scattering problem, those by assumption are also describing things that you would label the free problem with. And so there exists a corresponding set of alphas and betas which are describing the the eigenstates of the free problem. Say, whereas, H in or out so in the scattering problem, you wouldn't have had these operators. You would have just had, I start with something which looks like alpha in the remote past and looks like beta in the remote future. I ask for the transition amplitude between those things. That would be what you mean by the scattering problem. And then you get this expression if you just chase through basically chase through this statement. If I multiply through by e to the iht here, you know, I got that psi plus or minus is equal to e to the iht from d to the minus h naught t times the perturbed thing. And this quantity is often called capital omega of t. And you follow those capital omegas of t around, and they group themselves into an evolution operator whose expansion and power is a v, if you're doing perturbation theory, gives you this sum over n and the integral of the time order product of the v's. Right? So I'm going to more or less do that again, but where we're going to follow these operators true. And the special case where there's no operators will be the standard argument as to where the S matrix comes from. So what we want to do is transfer from here to here to show that this is true. So we just use the definition. So we know that the Heisenberg representation operators are given by e to the I ht, you know, times the Schrodinger representation operators. And we know that the interaction picture representation operators, I don't need to follow it yet, I guess. I'll just follow the time for now. And so that tells us that the Heisenberg representation operator is e to the I ht e to the minus I h naught t times the interaction picture representation. And that's this thing I called omega down there.
Was flowing the other way.
What do you mean by flowing?
The evolution, the time evolution. The potential of V of T is equal to E to the I H naught tau. Yeah.
Oh, have I got something wrong there?
Oh, no. I think I wrote it down wrong.
Yeah, sorry. So this is the basic relationship between the Heisenberg and the interaction picture operators. So we just use that here. So if we take the left-hand side, that'll be equal to so it's beta out unordered product of omega. What do I call that? T1? All right, X1 naught. A1 interaction. We can also relate, you know, we're trying to get something involving these free particle states again. And the relationship between them and the exact states is this one again, that they're also related by omega. So this t goes to plus or minus infinity story is just to do with where we evaluate omega at plus or minus infinity. But for both plus and minus, the exact eigenstate is related to this, because that's just really the statement that the state, the exact evolution, was giving you the free evolution in the asymptotic regime. So we can trade. I'll do this. This is the kind of thing that, you know, you. That means that I can trade this for the free state with an omega inverse of basically infinity. And here we'll have omega of minus infinity alpha. So that's the thing we're trying to relate to what we want. So now this time ordering has got a bunch of, you know, these things could be in all possible orders. Let's just choose a particular term in that time ordering where this is the earliest and this is the latest. And then this, everything I'm going to do will go through for all the other orderings. You'll just have to relabel all the coordinates. So let's focus on the case, you know, where x1-naught is, I forgot now. We want earliest to the left? We want latest to the left, yeah. Is bigger than x2-naught. So just I want to pick one of the terms in the time ordering. It's a sum of all possible orderings, so just choose one of those terms in the sum. In that case, we don't have to worry about the time ordering. So if we do that, then we can just think of what we really have is this. And so then we always have this combination omega inverse omega, omega inverse omega, omega inverse omega. So what we'll do is we'll define in the usual way the time evolution operator t prime to be omega inverse of t omega t prime. So what we need is a perturbative expression for u, and this is the usual. Now I'm just repeating what you just normally do for the S matrix. If you're doing driving this, if you're driving that top line for the S matrix, you'd have the same story, except you'd only have it once. You just have this one u, and all these guys in the middle wouldn't be there. And so what you need is a solution for what u is perturbatively in the interaction piece v. And so what we do is just differentiate it. So du dt, respect to the second argument, let's say. It's, put in the definitions of what omega is, and you pick up a piece here. So we got omega inverse was what? It's e to the I h naught t so I'll get a piece which is, I h naught minus h. I want to make sure I do this right. This is going to be, there's always the ordering issue, right? So if you differentiate this thing, I can differentiate the h, I can ih, and the question of where I put the ih relative to everything else is what counts. I can put it either side of this because h naught computes with itself. The only thing I don't want to do is put an h naught past this because h naught and h may not commute. So what I'll do is, rather than winging it, let me just write it in the order where I want it. Gives me what I want. Yeah, so I'll put the e to the ih naught on the right. And I've got IH naught minus IH, e to the minus IHT. And then I've got the omega, as long as the right. So what this is this is minus IV. Because remember, the Hamiltonian was H naught plus V. And what this does, if I put an e to the minus I h naught t here, e to the plus I h naught t, then this with this will convert this to the interaction representation. So this is going to be minus I, what I've been calling v of t. And then this with this is giving me another omega inverse, which combined with that gives me a u. Right, so we have d u of t and t prime t that is equal to that. Yes. So what we're trying to do is to find an expression for u which is a series in V, and the way to do that is just to do it iteratively, right? So to zero, we have the boundary condition that U of T equals T prime is just, that's just omega inverse of T times omega of T, so that's one. And so what we can do is we can, as the, you know, the zeroth order solution would be to integrate, take this to be one, integrate, and we'll get something involving the integral of V, stick that back into the solution and iterate order by order. And so if we do that iteratively, then we get this usual solution that U of T, T prime is equal to, you know, the sum n equals 0 to infinity minus I to the n, which is coming from that iterated. The n factorial is not there to start off with, but you'd get an integral from minus infinity to tau, say tau 2, d tau 1. That's right. Infinity d tau 1, minus infinity to tau 2, tau 1, d tau 2. So that's the solution.
That's U minus infinity.
You're right. Sorry. Thank you. So I should have written D prime T. Thank you. And then the time ordering comes in from the trick that it's kind of a pain to deal with these separate limits, but you can make all the limits the same here at the expense of putting in time ordering and dividing by n factorial. So this is the standard argument that you get in quantum mechanics. Integral from t prime t d tau 1 tau n, where they now share all the same limits of time ordered product of E tau 1. And the idea is that, who's not seen this line before? This is it's one of the things that you'll see in a standard quantum mechanics course. That's where the time orderings are coming from. So all we do is we plug this into wherever we last wrote our formula. I thought we had it here somewhere. Here. So everywhere we've got basically this combination here is U of infinity x1, 0. And this next one will be U of x1, 0, x2, 0. And this last one is U of xk, 0, minus infinity. And so we have these U's, and we're looking for a series in V. This is the expression for U in terms of V. So we just plug that in there. And you see what you're going to get is that you're going to get a series in between each of these operators, A. So the left-hand side looks reasonably ugly. So the left-hand side is going to turn into the expression. Let's see. So it'll be the sum. So we're going to have one of these for each of the u's, and we have a u basically for each operator. So we'll have n1 goes from 0 to infinity to. So we have a u for every operator, but then we have another one on the other end. So we're going to have a total of k plus 1 u's. Minus I to the n1 plus n2 divided by n1 factorial. And then we've got the matrix element, which is, I guess we have the integrals. We have integral t1. So I'm starting on the left here where I'm going from t1 to infinity, so I guess I could call it x1 naught to infinity. tau 1, 1. This one first label is labeling that I'm going from x1 to infinity, and the second one is the is the thing that's appearing in the sum, so it's going to go 1, 1 to n1. Tau 1, 1. And we'll have an integral from x2 naught to x1 naught. Tau 2, 1. So on. And then we'll end up with a minus infinity to xk naught. Tau is what? That'll be k plus 1. And then we've got the matrix element, which is beta times all these time ordered products. So we have time ordered product of v tau 1, 1, v tau 1, n 1. And we have a 1, and what we've done, that's in the interaction picture, a 1 in the interaction picture. Eventually, we have close off with a k in the interaction picture xk and the time ordered product of e. I've got k plus 1, comma 1. Right, so you got kind of a dog's breakfast there. So the missing step is to show, is to argue why this is the same as this. And the argument is a combinatorial argument, right? Because the difference between this and this is that we've partitioned, you know, a subset of the n. You know, if we define, so what we'll do is we'll define n with no subscript to be the sum of n1 plus all the other n's, k plus 1. So then we've got an overall minus, so minus I to the sum n1 plus n, k plus 1. That's our minus I to the n. So if I do that, maybe let me just rewrite this front factor in a way which will be useful. So I'll write this as minus I to the n. And I'll leave the sum there. What I'll do is, so I have to rewrite this denominator. So we've got the minus I to the n. I'm going to divide by the n factorial because I'm going to want to see that. So then I have to multiply it again because it wasn't there before. So here's the point. So if you write this thing out, what do you have? You've got n interaction Hamiltonians. And in general, if we take a particular ordering, these things are going to be, you know, because the tau 1 is being integrated over everything from minus infinity to infinity, sometimes these will be earlier in the ordering than the a's. Sometimes they'll be later in the ordering than the a's. Sometimes they'll be between the a's. And if you take a particular snapshot of things where I have a particular number, say, you know, n one of them to the that are earlier than all the, or later than all the a's, and then I have another n two which are whose times are between x one and x two, and so on, to get something like this. What I'm doing is essentially taking a quantity of n objects, and I'm sticking them into, you know, k plus 1 slots. And the ordering of the v's, you know, so if I take, so supposing there was a total of 6 v's to the left of a1, I don't care about the ordering of those things because they're going to be time ordered too. And so when I compare to this expression where I've got a time ordering, it doesn't really matter what the ordering of these guys were because the time ordering will take care of that. So what I'm going to get if I express this thing in that way, where I focus on the times when these v's are some of the v's are to the left of all the a's, some other number definite number are between a1 and a2 and so on. I have to count the number of times that will happen, right? So I'm asking the combinatorial problem of taking n objects and putting them into k plus 1 boxes where I don't care about the ordering of the objects in each box. And there's a total number of n factorial divided by that ways of doing that partition. And so the claim is that this is the same as this because all that's happened here is you've taken the time ordering and you've broke it up explicitly into the specific cases where the v's are on various sides of the a's. And you've multiplied by the number of times that that happens, given that you don't care about the ordering of the v's in any one of those time orderings. So that's why it's true. What's that?
I think the horse is dead.
Oh, good. Oh, you're happy? It's one of those combinatorial arguments are one of those things that you either don't get them or you get them. So if you got them, then that's great. All right, so that's the master expression. So this is the thing that we're going to use. And what it does is it tells you how to describe something. This is something which it's easier to make exact statements about because it's something where the evolution is in terms of didn't have to split H into H naught and V in order to talk about it, which you had to do here. But this is something which has an explicitly easy to calculate perturbative expansion. And so it's the bridge between a perturbative calculation and a thing for which you can make an exact statement. So what are the kinds of exact statements you can make? So we can start off with the simple ones. So we can talk about the symmetry properties of correlation functions. So for the interaction picture, we know that, for instance, things like momentum, three momentum, p, acting on a particle state, let me make the statement and see if you're happy with it. So the claim is that if I take a destruction operator and I commute the momentum operator with it, I'm going to just get minus k. Are people happy with the statement? So the way to prove the statement is to show that it's true acting on any state you like. And so a basis of states are the ones that are created by these states. So if you take something with particle 1 has momentum q1, and I'll suppress the other index q2, so I have some n particle state, then if I act on it with a, then I either get 0 if none of these particles are this one, or I get one less particle if this is destroying one of these particles, right? So this is equal to 0 if q1 is not equal to k1, q1 is not equal to k1, okay? Or I get, if one of them was equal to k, then I get, q1, ql, then omit k, so I get the state where I remove the particle of momentum k. So now if I want to prove this expression, what I just do is I take p times a, operate on the state, take a times p, operate on the state. So if I take ak acting on p, operating on the state q1 qn, if I'm getting zero when I hit it with A, it's easy because it's certainly true that this thing on zero will be this thing on zero. So let me look at this case because that's the more interesting one. So here, that when P acts in the state, I get the sum of sum I equals 1 to N QI as the eigenvalue. And then I have A acting on the state, which just removes the particle we're talking about. So we have Q1, QL, omit particle that was destroyed, Qn.
So this is for bosons, right?
Yeah, I'm doing bosons here, right? But it'd be the same for fermions.
But with a negative sign, if it has to...
The signs would be more complicated if you go through and ask, in here, there'd be a sign, depending on how often you had to go by somebody to destroy it. But that sign's going to go along the right. All I want to show is that this commutator, this for fermions, it's still true, this commutator, this won't be an anti-commutator, it'll be commutator in all cases. And that sign will just be kind of going along for the ride in the argument I'm making. We take P in the other order. Then what happens first is that we remove the state, and then we take the eigenstate of momentum. And so what we're going to get is the sum I equals 1 to N of Q minus K on the same state. Omit K. So that shows you that on any state in the spaces, this difference is equal to, if I take this, I guess I want this minus this, I'm going to get this minus this, and that gives me this statement. So this operator statement is true acting on any element of basis. It must be true as an operator statement. Good. So if that's true, and then if our fields are satisfying things like phi, the interaction vector field, phi of x was the sum over some spins, an integral d3p of some factors, which I won't write. Times some wave function, which depends on p and sigma, e to the I px, a p sigma. Then there's a complex conjugate piece, which would involve, so it's going to be stuff e to the minus I px, a star p sigma. Then you can see that if I take the commutator, this implies that the commutator of P with phi I of x will just be this integral with the commutator of P with the A's, which I'll use here. I'll just get minus K in front of the A. And if I take the complex conjugate of this thing, I'm going to get plus K in front of this A star. And so the minus K here corresponds to, it'll be P. It'll be minus P. It'll be whatever the momentum was of A. It'll be the sum over sigma. And that's just, this is e to the I p dot x, so it'll be I gradient of phi. All right, so is there a question back there? Are you confused? Or?
No, I was just wondering what the ellipse is about, but it's just U dagger, right?
Oh, it's just U dagger, yeah. It's just not writing that, yeah. I should have just wrote plus C. So now there's two ways to go. The simplest way to go would be if the momentum commutes with H naught and also commutes with H, then it also commutes with omega. So if P commutes with omega of T, which is amounts to saying that P commutes with both the free Hamiltonian and the full Hamiltonian, then if this is true for the interaction picture, it's also true for the Heisenberg picture. So P with phi h of x will be I the gradient of phi h of x. If it doesn't commute with both h naught and h, then what you would do is you define P to be the interaction picture version of P. So you take p e to the, you know, e to the I h naught t times p e to the minus I h naught t. And then p here would be related to this p in the same way that the, oh, sorry. P here would be related to this p in the same way that phi Heisenberg is related to phi interaction. And then this is just a similarity transformation of this. So it's true in either case, but it's most simply true in this case. In the simplest field theories, this is what happens. Same thing, you know, so everything I said here could have applied to an internal charge, you know, so for charge, if your states are labeled by charge as well as momentum and spin, you know, if Q on a state Q alpha, say momentum and alpha is some Q alpha, then just repeat word for word what I said. You know, it's got to be true that the commutator of Q with a destruction operator has to be minus Q alpha times the destruction operator. And so it has to also be true that the fields, you know, if I do the commutator with a field, I'll get a factor of a number here, which I can no longer think of as being a gradient because I can't think of it as being a derivative acting on that field. But it'll mean that Q with the interaction representation will just be minus Q Let me suppress the alpha here because alpha is. We can leave it in, but then we have to label the field by that alpha. It's the thing that tells you what particle you're talking about. Let's put alpha. And that'll be true for any conserved charge because all we're really assuming here is that Q is commuting with the Hamiltonian, which would be true for conserved charge. So the conservation part is important because the thing that gets you from the interaction to the Heisenberg picture is the Hamiltonian, and so you want to make sure that you're talking about something that commutes with that. We already know that the equation of motion for, you know, we took the Hamiltonian with the Heisenberg field. You know, we already know that that's equal to plus I ddt of phi. Because we know that's true for any Heisenberg operator. And so we combine that with that, then we know that if you take the four momentum operator, I guess there's a minus sign here. So we could do this properly, right? So let's you know, what I'm saying here is just a stupid thing, right? This is phi Heisenberg is equal to e to the I h t phi e to the minus I h t. So ddt of phi Heisenberg, we're going to get an I h on the right left-hand side. And then the second time, we're going to get a minus I h. So it's going to be this. So that means h with phi will be minus I ddt of phi h. So if I combine this with this, keeping in mind what the metric is, we know that there's a simple covariant statement. So we know that I take p mu with phi Heisenberg. That's going to be I partial mu to Heisenberg. And if you're worried about the fact that there was a minus sign here, you have to remember that the Hamiltonian is p upper 0. And so when we raise the metric in the time direction, we get a minus sign for a minus plus 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 metric. All right. So those are useful because they say something about correlation functions. So now first, so let's look at something like let me make sure I do this right here. I'm going to lie to you a little bit here, right? So I don't have to know. So we've done time-ordered products here. I'm going to start differentiating them. And I want to pass the derivative right past the time ordering. So everything I've said here, we could have equally well talked about the T star product, right? The one that you get from the path integral, which was defined by the property that for an ordinary time ordering, if I differentiate with respect to the arguments, sometimes I pick up the derivatives of the step functions that are enforcing the time orderings. And that gives me something that is involves the two of these points being evaluated at the same point, but it ruins the ability to pass a derivative through the time ordering. And you remember the story of the path integral was that the path integral gives you a time ordering where derivatives actually go straight through the time ordering. And that's a good thing because the failure of a derivative to go through the time ordering is partly responsible for, you know, the thing that's not, the difference between the derivative of the inside and the outside is the thing that's not covariant in these correlation functions. And that's the thing that's canceling non-covariant things in the Hamiltonian when we're calculating the S matrix. But for when these positions are all different from one another, then T star and T are the same. But nothing I said here distinguishes the time ordering from this, you know, the covariant time ordering. And so what I'm about to do is take a derivative of this. And when I do it, I'm implicitly thinking of using this T star product because I'm going to take the derivative right through the time ordering. And I'm not going to worry about what it does to the time ordering itself. So if we take the derivative, you know, with respect to x, I'll say dd x mu of the T star ordering of a1 x1 plus x, ak Heisenberg xk plus x. Actually, you know, for this, where I shift everybody, it probably doesn't make a difference because x is going to drop out of the time orderings. So I might not have needed this T star, but it's so that's going to be the T star of, you know, dvx mu of a1h. And for each of these things, I can take the commutator. I can use this. And then I'll have a series of commutators, one for each of these terms in succession. And if I follow that through, that's the same thing as the so that's minus I times the time ordering of commutator of P mu with this whole operator, A1H. Are you all happy with that? So the P's, if I take the commutator P with a whole bunch of operators, it's going to break up into what I would have had here if I took the commutators. I traded all these derivatives for commutators. You happy with that, or do you want me to fill in the step? I'm just saying that P with AB, you know, is P AB minus AB P, which is P A B minus P or A P B plus A P B minus A B P, and that's the commutator of P with A and B plus A times the commutator of P with B. So this derivative is giving you a bunch of terms like this, which all are combined into the commutator P with the product. So if I take a matrix element, like the kind of things that we're doing, if you take the you know, ddx mu of some matrix element in an out state of a time-ordered product of a1h x1 ak then I can think of the P doesn't depend on time. It's just some operator that doesn't depend on time. So I could take P out of the time ordering if I want. So it's minus I, you know, beta out P times the time ordering of all the stuff that we had in the time ordering. And then there's a plus I, which is the other term in the commutator. So be where P will be on the other side of these operators, so it'll be off to right on the right. Now the thing is that we've seen that the eigenstates, you know, the momentum is conserved, and a conserved charge would be the same story. It commutes with a Hamiltonian. I can label all my states with the momentum and the conserved charge and energy. And I can do that for the free states as well. And so in the same way that for the free particles, we had that the you know, momentum acting on a state gives you the, you know, all the states are momentum eigenstates, I can use the same thing for these P's. P's acting on these exact scattering states are also going to be eigenstates. Yeah?
Where's the x without a subscript dependence in, so that line you just wrote the left-hand side? Like, where does just the x without a subscript?
Oh, I forgot to write the plus x's,
right,
yeah.
So that,
thank you.
Okay, they all have plus x's.
Yeah, they all have plus x's. I'm just copying that is what I should have been doing. Thank you.
On the right-hand side, did you want a minus between the two terms?
Yeah, I do. Minus I and then plus I. So the upshot is that we've got dd x mu beta out that's equal to, so it'll be minus I. The eigenvalue now, p beta, and I guess I wanted to have p mu here, right? I wasn't just doing free momentum. I was doing, you know, this derivative included time. So I'm using the version up there that the commutator, the four momentum p with phi is the derivative. Minus p alpha. I got too many indices now, so this is, I'll put the superscript for the labeling which state it was. Or actually, maybe I'll say p beta minus p alpha mu. So these are the four vectors, which are the eigenvalues of p acting on alpha and beta. So far, so good. So now you can think of this as a differential equation, for this is some unknown function, and you can integrate it as a function of x. Because it's basically, it's a derivative of a function is equal to a constant times a function. Those are solved by exponentials, right? So that tells us that the x dependence of this thing is beta out. So that's just telling us, you know, something that I used actually earlier about the x dependence of a correlation function. That if you translations, you know, this is telling us, you know, what you probably believe anyway is that momentum, the four momentum operator is generating translations, and so this shows you explicitly how that happens. Similar story if we just did the same thing literally for a charge. Instead of having a derivative, we would have used this. And same story that we had you know, this is for the interaction picture, but it's also true for the Heisenberg picture. For the same arguments that it commutes with it, with if it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So if we did the same thing here, what would happen is that we'd have, you know, the we took the commutator. So if we kind of came in on the line where we're commuting things. So if we started off with evaluating this, where this is a charge, we would have had charge times this minus this times charge would be equal to the charge acting on this state and the charge acting on the alpha state. And again, because the charge is conserved, I can diagonalize it together with the Hamiltonian, so I can label these states by the charge. And so if we did it for a charge, we would have had a similar statement. We would have had a statement that, let me make the statement the way I want to defend. So if I take beta, the commutator now between time ordered product of, you know, A1, X1, AK, XK. That's going to be equal to charge of alpha minus the charge of beta.
You mean
here?
No, in the previous part.
Well, depends what you mean by the word identities. But the word identities, the way we talked about them before, were expressions of gauge invariants. And this isn't saying anything about that. This is just saying how translations work on the correlation functions. And so it's kind of logically independent of gauge invariants. This is kind of like a word identity statement in the sense that if you have a charge, it's weaker than the word identities we had because that was a local symmetry. But here, it's constraining how correlation functions behave depending on if there's a conserved charge in the problem. So what's the content of this equation? Supposing that we had chosen a bunch of operators here that were, you know, whenever you've got a conserved charge, there's a symmetry that goes with it. If you'd chosen a bunch of operators that were invariant under the symmetry, then that they would be ones for which the commutator of Q with those operators would be zero. So then the left-hand side would be zero if we had chosen these operators A to be a product for which there's no net charge. And then this side would then have to vanish. And so that shows you that if you have a non-zero matrix element, it can only be between states for which the charges are equal in that case. Or conversely, if this thing was not invariant under the symmetry, so did not commute with Q, but supposing it had a definite charge, so the commutator of Q with this thing was proportional to this thing again, then so supposing it were true that A1 to AK commutator with Q was equal to some number, C times A1 to AK, that would be like saying this thing has charge C or minus C or something. And the same argument would say that we'd have C times the matrix element of this thing on the left-hand side is equal to this. And so if this thing is non-zero, it would have to be true that Q alpha minus Q beta was equal to C. And so there's a selection rule which says that the states for which there's non-zero matrix elements are governed by what the net charge is of the operators you're taking a matrix element of. All right. So this is probably beating a...
Sure.
Well, this was the same argument with momentum, right? And it's a little bit different because the commutator P is giving you derivatives. So I guess the analog of the statement of invariance would be that if you had something, an operator which didn't depend on X, then P would commute with it. And so then the momenta of the states that contributed to the matrix element of the operator would have to be equal.
Right, so what I mean is, what kind of operator do you have for the expectation value of that explicitly depends on X? normally you would calculate expectation values of like products of fields and things like that, right? Which are shown to have an explicit exponent.
Sure.
Well, you do, because the fields all depend on it. You might ask, what can I get that doesn't depend on x? And an example of that would be q or p, which come to you as an integral of the field. So there's no x left. Right, because we know that p doesn't commute with fields, because it's, you know, that's what this is. So in the notes here, I could do the same thing with charge conjugation. If you have discrete symmetry, but it's you know, beating over the head of the same thing. So if you have a discrete symmetry under which the fields change sign, say, and the states are invariant, then you have to have an even number of these fields to have a non-zero correlation. And that underlines, it's in the notes because there's a thing in quantum electrodynamics called Fourier's theorem. It says that if you take a correlation function of an odd number of gauge fields, electromagnetic fields, it's exactly zero because charge conjugation forbids it from being non-zero. So charge conjugation is a symmetry of quantum electrodynamics under which the gauge potential changes sign. And so an argument like this for charge conjugation would show you that if you assume that the vacuum is charge conjugation invariant, then a correlation function in the vacuum of an odd number of gauge potentials would have to vanish just because the same kind of argument as I gave here for charge conjugation. All right. But rather than doing that, let's start the next topic of discussion.
Question. So in that, on the top border in the last, no, the bottom border in the top line, you apply the derivative to the things inside, and then you get the commutator of the momentum with the A.
Yeah.
But don't you have to take the partial derivative of the ket and the bra as well?
No, because they don't depend on x. I think you're thinking again, in quantum mechanics. If you'd evaluated the matrix element xp or something like that, that would be the EDI px sort of. That would be the wave function. That's, I think, what you're thinking about. That would depend on x. But what we're talking about here is like the momentum state. It's something which we haven't taken the overlap with that position state. And so these states don't have any x dependence at all.
Oh, but don't they have time dependence? Or is
not in
x
the,
is like a extra variable that's added?
So there's no time dependence in the Heisenberg picture, which is what we're in. In the Schrodinger picture, all the time dependence is carried by the states. But in the Heisenberg picture, the states don't have any time dependence.
Okay.
So all the burden of the space-time dependence is in the field. What's nice about the Heisenberg picture is that all the fields are carrying the burden of space-time dependence. And so everything that is to be differentiated is explicitly in these operators because of that. Okay. So let me start the next topic. So we're starting point. So what's nice about the point of introducing these Heisenberg representation fields is that there are some things you can say exactly about correlation functions independent of perturbation theory. And that's not very many things you can say along those lines, so it's useful knowing which ones you can. So one of those things, you know, those symmetry things were one of those things, but the next thing is the Lehmann, the LSZ reduction. I can't remember who, probably Lehmann, Szymanczyk, and Zimmermann, I think, but it's, so it's a general relationship between correlation functions, the way we've been defining them, and S-matrix elements. And the advantage is, you know, the point of it, you might say, well, so we already had an expression, a perturbative expression that I erased here. You give me a correlation function in perturbation theory, I can write it as a sum of correlations of various operators in interaction representation. And if the operators weren't there, then that would include the S matrix. And the point of this is that it's never going to say a word about perturbation theory. And so, in particular, it's going to give a relationship between correlation functions of operators and SW elements, but it'll apply equally well to bound states as it will to elementary particles. So if you had been looking at, I don't know, the vacuum, there's an algorithm that'll, this is an algorithm that gives you S matrix elements, but if you looked at the correlation function, say, something like, I guess in notes I'm thinking of a deuteron, but so deuteron is a neutron and a proton, right? So we want an operator which would be, say, neutron conjugate bar proton. So something which is not one, so several fields evaluated at the same point, so it's a composite operator. And you know, say proton conjugate bar neutron of y. If you can calculate this correlation function in the vacuum, in the, you know, the exact vacuum, so maybe you're doing it in a lattice or something like that, then if there's a state that could appear in, if I put a complete set of states in between these two operators, if there's a state, a stable state, like the deuteron in this case, which is even which has the property that it has a non-zero matrix element, you know, say deuteron between P bar conjugate and probably want it the other way around. These are the wrong operators. O1, O2. Something involving a proton and neutron. O1 of X, O1 dagger of Y. All you need to know is that O1, the matrix element between the vacuum and the deuteron, is not zero. And then it's given that that's true, you can find the S matrix element for deuteron scattering, if you like, by looking at correlation functions of this operator with itself any time. That's what the LSC deduction will tell you. It tells you that if you have correlation functions of any operators, regardless of whether they're composite or not, you can identify the S matrix as by looking at the singularity structure of this thing in momentum space. If you start Fourier transforming with respect to X and Y and ask when does this thing blow up, it blows up typically when you're kinematically in a regime where scattering could happen, and there's a specific set of factors that you can, this quantity will have a singularity if you choose the external momenta, the Fourier transform momenta, to be such that you've made a state like this be kinematically allowed. And then if you look at the singularity, there's a piece that blows up, and then there's a bunch of stuff beside that multiplies that blowing up piece, one term of which is the S matrix element. So the rule is basically identify the singularity and see what its coefficients are, and what the coefficient, you know, where the S matrix appears in the coefficient. And then once you've done that, then the rule will be find the singularities, divide by these other factors, and what's left will be the S matrix. But it's the reason why if you're calculating, say, you know, proton matrix elements in lattice QCD or something, so you're using operators, that's probably a better example. If I'd use Q bar Q here, say, that's something in QCD which, for which there's a matrix element between the vacuum and a meson state. But that meson state is not some simple perturbative state made out of quarks and gluons. But if you can calculate the correlation function of Q bar Q and Q bar Q at different points for many values of Q bar Q, then, and if it, by some means, say on a lattice or whatever your favorite way is, you can pick out meson scattering amplitudes from that correlation function because of this LSC reduction formula. So it's telling you something which, if you specialize to fields, elementary fields like phi 1 and phi 2, it's not such a big deal. But it's the generality of the argument is what's important, is that it really is not relying on these fields being elementary fields with creation annihilation operator expansions. It's something which is true regardless of what these operators are, as long as these matrix elements are not zero for the states of interest. Okay, so let's start that off. So let's imagine that we're going to look at a correlation function. So it's some vacuum time-ordered product of a bunch of operators. And again, they're going to be, there's nothing particularly special about what they are.
And we're interested in going to momentum space. So let's focus on let's Fourier transform this thing. So let's calculate integral d4p, I guess I want, d4x, e to the minus ipx of this thing. And we'll call that m. And we're going to follow it as a function of p, which is the Fourier transform variable of x. And it also depends, of course, on x1 and all the other positions of these other operators. This is a definition. So we're interested in, the question we want to ask is, not directly, so I should say that this reduction, it's a thing that relates correlation functions to S matrix elements. But we're going to kind of back into it. What we're going to ask is just, supposing you're doing this, you're interested in this correlation function, and you're interested in when, as a function of momentum, does it blow up? Then
what's that d one?
The d here? It's just some state. So I was thinking of protons and neutrons, and I was thinking of the deuteron as being a bound state of a proton and a neutron. That would be an example we could talk about, but then I garbled what the operator was, so I probably it was a bad example. So what we're going to ask is, m of p x1 as a function of p. Now, typically, if this thing has got a, you know, if you think of this as being some integrand, if it's a smooth function, the way that you're going to get a divergence out of this, you know, how do you get divergences of integrals? Either the integrand blows up, or you've got a bounded integrand where the range of integration blows up. So the suspicious area to look for here would be the case where if the time ordering is such that A is on the far left of this ordering, then the integral over X is going to be over an infinite range, because it's going to go from whatever the last, you know, the time part of it, it's going to go from whatever the last, you know, whatever X1 was to infinity. And so that'll be a dangerous range to follow. And if that's not blowing up, in order to have something go singular, you generically have to have this integrand blow up someplace, which we're not going to follow. So we're interested in particular, the divergences, or whether there's a divergence to do with the infinite range of integration that happens when this particular operator is on one side or the other side of the time ordering. In particular, if X naught is bigger than X one naught and the rest of them, or if X naught is less than X one naught and the rest of them, then does the semi-infinite range and you're not going to be surprised to find that it does. And so probably this is a good place to stop. What we'll do is we'll isolate the divergence. So if A is to the far left, what we can do is we can put a complete set of states in between A and everything else, and then evaluate how the answer depends on X, which we can do because we know a lot about how things depend on X based on the momentum of the how the various things, the initial and final state depends on, you know, what its eigenvalue was under momentum. So we'll use that information over there to evaluate the x dependence of the matrix element between 0, A, whatever the complete set of states was, and the rest. And we'll be able to do the integral over X explicitly, and you can kind of watch the divergence happen. And so we're interested in, you know, for what values of P does it happen, and that kind of thing. And it'll happen when there's a, for every state that you can insert in that complete set of states, when you make P, when you put P on shell for that state, so you make its momentum and energy agree with the dispersion relation for that state, that's when you're going to get a singularity in this thing. That's probably a good place to pick it up next time.